Hear ye, hear ye, hear ye. The Supreme Court of the State of South Dakota, the Honorable David Gilkerson presiding, is now open for the transaction of any business that may legally come before it.
Good morning. This is the time and the place set in the matter of a special rules hearing by order of this court. The record may show that under our procedures, a person who is not a person who submitted a proposed rule must file with the court in advance of this hearing notice of intent to appear and either oppose or support or give comment. And that in this case, we've received no such notices from any member of the public. Nevertheless, we will proceed with the rules as members of the bar and Mr. LeBrun's committee are here that have sponsored rules. Rule number, proposed rule number one is an amendment to SDCL 12631.4. Any comments on that? Okay, being none, go to proposal number two. Proposal number two is an amendment to 15656C, and Mr. Barnett, I assume you wish to speak.
Very briefly, Chief Justice, you may recall, and the court may recall, that we appeared in February rules hearing with a proposal to amend 56C, and shortly before that, we discovered that 56C and 6D would be inconsistent, so we withdrew, and our committee studied it, and the membership approved at the June meeting the proposed rule number two, which would reconcile 56C and 6D. That's just a brief history.
Okay. Any questions from the court for Mr. Barnett? All right. Proposal number three.
Thank you.
This would amend SDCL 16167.7. Mr. Barnett.
This proposal originally came at the annual meeting some 15 months ago. There was some concern and discussion in the halls about perhaps a law professor that would come in, teach for 1 year, gain admission, with the idea that they would then be able to continue practice here without showing the length and duration and dedication to the rule of law in South Dakota. So we tabled that a year ago, and the Bar Commissioner set up a special committee chaired by Professor Hutton with a couple other members, and that was then approved by the Bar Commissioners at its spring meeting, submitted to the membership at the annual meeting in June, and it's now before you. Briefly, as an aside, because of the notice requirements of the Supreme Court on its rules and the scheduling of the Bar Convention, we submitted these in advance to the court to meet its publication requirements, but had not yet submitted it to the membership. The membership did approve it. I do note that we need a small amendment. If I direct your attention to the second line of the underlined change, we need to insert full-time administrator or faculty member. That was an oversight on our part. It's certainly our intent that a full-time administrator admitted under Rule 7.7 would likewise be treated similar to a retiring law professor.
My understanding on that point is, visiting with Dean Vickery, is that under ABA standards, he's not considered a faculty member because he spends significant amounts of time being an administrator, i.e. the dean of the law school, correct?
That's correct, Chief Justice. And in fact, if you looked at the history of this rule, you'll find that in the early 90s, we amended this rule because in its original form, it only allowed full-time law professors to obtain that status. And, of course, when Dean Vickery came in, he also was teaching, and I guess it was an oversight because the prior dean also was teaching. In any event, so in the early 90s, we amended this to cover people like Dean Vickery. We forgot to include him on this one, and that's why I suggest to the court that we tweak that just a little bit.
All right. Any questions from the bench for Mr. Barnett on this proposal?
Does it have to be inserted then every time then after that, the lines after that that refer to faculty member, or does it just need to be in that second line? the faculty or when the faculty member's employment is in the next line, and then it's again referred to if the faculty member has served as a full-time member. Does it need to be in any of the other lines?
I'll leave that to the discretion of the court, Justice. If you want to put it in on the fourth line, underlined, that's fine, too. It's one of interpretation, and I don't think it's going to be a problem, but if you want to be consistent, that's fine.
Any further questions for Mr. Barnett on this proposal?
Why not just use a generic term that covers them both or covers anybody in those capacities rather than continue to work? It gets a little clumsy if you do that.
I don't know how to improve it along the lines that you're suggesting, Justice.
Okay, we'll get it.
I'm confident of that.
Any further questions for Mr. Barnett on this proposal? If not, we'll go to number four. And this is also from the State Bar, and this would be a new rule regarding senior emeritus status. That would be a new number then, 1617.4.1. Mr. Barnett.
Thank you, Chief. This particular rule was also the product of a special subcommittee of the Bar Commissioners. We wanted to take them up at the same time, so while Professor Hutton was working with her subcommittee on the law professor and full-time administrator rule, my committee was working on emeritus status. We looked around the country. There are a number of states that have rules that provide emeritus status. Some give emeritus status, low dues, reduced dues, and so forth. The problem with that is that we have set, this court has set a public policy that says if you are going to practice law, you have to disclose the lack of malpractice insurance. And we didn't want to change that policy. We were the first state in the country to do so. So we drafted the emeritus status rule to provide an opportunity for retired lawyers and judges to perform public service through recognized pro bono referral programs. At the same time, we recognize that the emeritus status, if they're just taking pro bono, they're not going to buy malpractice insurance. However, if it's through an official referral program such as the Legal Services Program or our own Access to Justice, I have malpractice insurance for them. So we can protect the public so long as they are under the pro bono referral program. And that's why I included the footnote in this draft, so that if they want to represent friends and neighbors, even if it's for free, they're not entitled to this status. Because if you're going to dabble in practice law, then you buy your malpractice insurance or make that material disclosure to your client that you don't have malpractice insurance. So this is an opportunity for a very reduced rate at the inactive dues level for retired judges and lawyers to give back to society. We have the structure and the safeguards there. And I'll be happy to answer any questions.
Questions from the bench for Mr. Barnett.
And that was approved at the bar meeting as well?
Yes, Justice, it was.
I believe unanimously, wasn't it?
It was, your Chief Justice.
Yeah. Any further questions for Mr. Barnett? If not, we'll go to proposal number five, and this involves... Got a question? Number five, and that is fees. Mr. Barnett.
Thank you, Chief Justice. Approximately every 10 years, we have to adjust the rule of the dues to reflect inflation and increased costs and so forth. The last time we brought this proposal to the court was in 1996, effective for the year, calendar year 1997. We would have brought this a year ago, and we've been given notice for several years that this was coming. However, with the Amendment E last year, where we were going to ask law firms and lawyers to contribute as best they could to help finance that campaign, the Bar Commissioners and I sat down and we agreed, if you will help us raise the funds to fight that attack on the rule of law in our judiciary, we will somehow manage to get by for one additional year before we ask the court to adjust those dues. And in fact, we accomplished that with this caveat. Last October, in order to make payroll and pay bills, I had to borrow $85,000. I bring that up to the court because we needed to do it a year ago. That, of course, was immediately repaid. I'm probably going to have to borrow between $85,000 and $100,000 to make payroll in the late fall this year also. Other than that, I'll be happy to answer questions. The end result is it increases CLE dues by $25 a year, which is still the best bargain in the entire country, and it increases the dues that go to pay for not only the administration but for discipline and so forth, and it increases that $75.
So if you're borrowing money now, when does this go into effect?
I would assume that if the court approves this proposal, when we send out the billing statements at Thanksgiving, it will be in effect, and that's when it'll so it'll be implemented for the 08 calendar year.
Oh, you go by calendar year?
Yes.
Okay.
Our fiscal year is August 1st through July 31st, but we've always done the billing on a calendar year.
All right. Further questions for Mr. Barnett from the bench?
When did it go to 240?
Excuse me?
When did it go to the 240? How many years ago is that?
It was effective for the calendar year 1997.
Oh, so it's been a while.
This will be 11 years.
Wow. Okay.
Okay. Further questions for Mr. Barnett? All right. Then we'll go to,
Number six,
yes. And this would be the modification to 16-19-24 dealing with the disciplinary board. Mr. Barnett.
Thank you, Chief. In the mid-1980s, and everybody here I'm sure can remember, when there was a rather large drug investigation of members of our profession, one of the members of the disciplinary board resigned after 1 year. What that has done is caused us to be out of sync for all these years. Because at the time, rather than to appoint for the unexpired term which the rule would permit, bar leadership at that point in time decided if we're going to do it, we want the full 6 years. So they just created the new additional 3 year and 3 year. As a result of that, next year in 08, the Chief Justice's appointment of the layperson have finished her 6 years. And two of my members will complete their term. So we have 3 out of 7 leaving at the same time. That is a very difficult strain on the personnel. Frankly, it's very inefficient. It takes a year to 2 years to bring a board member really up to speed. And so we have to work the seasoned veterans very, very hard with all the difficult cases for that first year or 2 years. The second thing that the members of the D board have been telling me for years is that 6 years is too long. They are burned out. And so based on their recommendation, we thought we would go to 1 5-year term. And all the existing members, both lay and lawyer, thought that 1 5-year term would be fine. But we needed some transition language to give us some flexibility to fix the problem so that after next year, that will be the last time that we'll be out of sync. And this proposal would allow us to get to the 5-year and also get to the flexibility where we only have one lawyer going off each year. The layperson may go off with a lawyer, but that's a significant improvement than having two lawyers and the layperson go off.
Why do you think they're getting burned out? Are they doing their own investigations now? I remember that Jim Zeiser used to do them all, and I don't know what the process is now.
Justice, we estimate that each lawyer who serves on the board is donating between $35,000 and $40,000 worth of billable time each and every year. It's about an hour to an hour and a half of mail every single day. And then on the cases where you're the lead, and I try to keep them balanced between the six people. The layperson receives all that material and reads it all, but we don't make them the lead investigator. That has to be a lawyer by policy. That you would spend considerably more time on those cases where you're the lead, and that is just a tremendous sacrifice. There's no greater contribution to the profession than that service. But 6 years, they tell us, is just too long. And in recognition of that, in the last year that they serve, at least it's been my policy since 1989, I don't assign the chair of the committee to be the lead except for those individual lawyers where they've always had them during their term. This simply recognizes that that isn't enough. We ought to cut it off at five.
What's the job of the lead? Are they the investigator?
They will do some investigation. We have Bob Freeburg as board counsel, and I have Larry Zastrow in my office as deputy counsel. If it requires going to a law office and spending a day or two going over or going through trust accounts and so forth, I will send one of those lawyers. If it's a matter of visiting with judges and lawyers, saying, "Tell me what you know about Joe," as background, the individual board members would do that, recognizing that if we've got a problem in Rapid City, that's a long, long way to send Bob Freeburg.
And so they're the investigator, except they're not a field investigator.
They, on occasion, will go to the law office and do spot checks of, like, the trust account or so forth. 80%.
Does that create a conflict then when they make a recommendation of some kind and then all of their cohorts or peers on the board are voting on what their recommendation is?
I guess this court has the ultimate authority to decide. Only public discipline can be imposed. So to the extent that somebody might raise a conflict of interest, our response is, if you don't like what the board is doing, then you can take it to the Supreme Court if you want to go public, and there's your impartial body. It's a recognition that we do the best we can with the limited resources that we have in South Dakota. Nebraska had a similar situation, a similar process that we did. They had it a little bit regionalized because they're bigger. They changed all that, and the cost went up about 300% because you're talking about hiring a whole bunch of staff to do that. And the board feels comfortable that since it cannot suspend a lawyer's license or publicly admonish them, much less disbar, that's this court's discretion, that the conflict of interest really isn't in play.
What was that 80%? You started talking about 80%. What's that? What was that?
80 to 85% of what the disciplinary board does is we take a complaint and we help the lawyer to improve their practice so that they don't have complaints in the future. In other words, we invest time helping those lawyers, thereby reducing the number of complaints against the lawyer and arguably reducing the chances of future complaints against that lawyer, which just involves a lot of more time on the board's part.
Okay. I have a question on the terminology here. Maybe I'm just not reading this right, but it goes, you first have the how they're selected, and then it says subsequent terms of all members shall be for a single 5-year term. What does that mean, subsequent terms? I would almost read this to mean they have an initial term and then a subsequent term, which would almost seem to indicate that it's more than 5-year terms. What can you explain that?
Yes, Justice. The numbered paragraphs above were language of this court to set up the initial terms with the idea that they would have a systematic rotation uniform, which is what we're trying to achieve. And it contemplated, after the initial appointment for a term, a subsequent additional 3-year term. What we're saying is we need to get back to the original 10 of the court, and to do that, we go a single 5-year term, and then we have the flexibility to get us back to where we belong.
Okay, so you think that the next sentence that says, no member shall serve for more than one complete term, satisfies this subsequent term? I mean, I look at this and, all right, let's say somebody was appointed for the three-year term, then they could also get appointed for the five-year term as a subsequent term. But what you're saying is the next sentence then would limit that to, even if they get reappointed, it's 5 years and they're out. Is that what you're saying?
My interpretation and the intent of the board here is if we had a member that for health reasons resigned with 1 year to go, we would never appoint somebody for 1 year because they'd just be sitting there. We can appoint them for 1 year. Then they would be eligible for a full five-year term. On the other hand, the flexibility at the end would say, we want to maintain that systematic only one lawyer coming off at a time. So that appointment for 1 year to fill the unexpired may only be for a four-year term instead of five to maintain our original goal. And that's what the intent is, however inartfully I may have drafted it.
Further questions for Mr. Barnett on this proposal? If not, we'll go to number seven.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Barnett. And this is a proposed new rule concerning the Uniform Mediation Act. Mr. LeBrun chaired a committee that studied this, and I know the committee spent a lot of time on that. And Mr. LeBrun,
thank you, Chief Justice.
Appreciate you coming today.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity to be here. Justice Sabers, it's nice to be on when you're on the panel. I'm the first member of our firm who was appeared before the court when Justice Sabers has been on the panel, so we appreciate that. As the Chief Justice indicated, I chaired a committee that he appointed last December to look into the Uniform Mediation Act, so I speak to you as chair of that committee, as well as I'm a life member of the National Conference of Commissioners of Uniform State Laws, which, of course, was the body that drafted the Uniform Mediation Act. The conference, as you probably are aware, has drafted a lot of uniform acts. It's 100 and, I think we're about 116 years old now, including the UCC and many, many other acts. And South Dakota has adopted a lot of our uniform acts. The first venture of the conference in this area was really the Uniform Arbitration Act, which the original act was drafted many years ago, and I think South Dakota adopted that in the 1970s, as I recall, or the 1970s. About 5 or 6 years ago, there was some effort or some suggestions that we look into revising the Uniform Arbitration Act. There were some provisions in it that were outdated. And while the conference was studying that, looking at it, they started thinking about mediation. And it turned out that the American Bar Association at that time, this would have been in the late 1990s, was also looking at doing something in the area of mediation. So for the first time in the history of the Uniform Laws Conference, we had a joint project with a drafting group from the American Bar Association. So we had a joint drafting committee, the members of the conference as well as members of the ABA dispute resolution section. And the two committees, although initially appointed separately, ended up meeting jointly for about 3-4 years to come up with the final product, which is what we're looking at here today. The Uniform Laws Conference Committee was chaired by former judge, Mike Getty from Illinois. Mike has been a member of the conference many years, and he had served on both the arbitration drafting committee, and then he chaired the mediation committee from the Uniform Laws Conference. The ABA section, their draft committee was chaired by former ABA President Roberta Roma Cooper and former Justice Tom Moyer of the Ohio Supreme Court. And just real briefly, when a conference undertakes a topic like this, it usually spends about a year studying it first. We appoint a study committee that looks into it, whether there's a need for the act, whether there's a need for uniformity. Once that decision has been made, then they appoint a drafting committee, as they did here. And the drafting committee meets in the interim, in the winter months, usually 2 or 3 times a year, and they have a reporter who does a first draft, and then when they meet as a drafting committee, they sit down and they go over the drafts line by line and look at it and study it. And then from the conference standpoint, it's presented to the conference 2 consecutive years, where again, it is read line by line before the entire body of the Uniform Laws Conference, which is usually around 250 to 300 members. And the body, when they meet as a committee as a whole, have the liberty to make amendments, to make suggestions. The draft committee goes back for another interim, makes more changes, and then it brings it back a second time to the Uniform Laws Conference annual meeting, where again it's debated, sometimes amended, and then it comes up for a vote by the states for a final, whether or not the conference is going to promulgate the act. The Uniform Arbitration Act was promulgated initially by the conference in 2002. In 2003, there was an amendment to make it reconcile with the UNCTAD. They have a uniform, they don't call it uniform, it's a model Reconciliation Mediation Act, and we wanted the two to go together, because a lot of times in business transactions, you know, you're running into global matters. And so the amendment that was adopted in 2003 just reconciled it with the UNCTAD Act. And that's now part of the Uniform Mediation Act. The Uniform Mediation Act has been adopted, I believe, now in about 9 states. This last year was introduced in, I think, 2 or 3 more, and some legislatures actually are still in session. I think New York, for example, is looking at it yet. The Arbitration Act, the initial one, was adopted in all 50 states. The amended Arbitration Act has been adopted in, I think, 12 or 13 states now, something like that. I don't need to advise this court of the prevalence of mediation, not just in South Dakota, but nationwide, and mediation has become a real tool in the arsenal of ultimate dispute resolution procedures that lawyers and courts are using. The Uniform Mediation Act basically is a rule of evidence. And when the chief first appointed our committee, he asked us to look at whether or not it could be adopted as a court rule rather than enacted by the legislature. And as the court is well aware, this court has adopted most of our evidence rules as a court rule. And so our committee reviewed it from that standpoint and concluded that, yes, it is a rule of evidence, and therefore it is something that could be adopted by court rule. I might mention, I told the chief this, when I was at the meeting of the Uniform Laws Conference just a month or so ago, I mentioned that this court is looking at adopting this as a court rule. And I had several members of our conference who were also on Supreme Courts. He said, what a great idea, and I think we're going to see more courts probably looking at adopting the Mediation Act as a court rule rather than send it to the legislature. As I mentioned, basically it's a rule of evidence, and in mediation, the key, of course, is confidentiality of the communication that takes place during a mediation conference, and then the privilege, so that you can't be hauled into court later and say, well, didn't you say this in the mediation hearing? So basically that's what this act deals with, is the confidentiality and the privilege, and it sets forth some exceptions in case there's discussion about committing a crime, for example. They're all set forth in the act. I'm going to go under the assumption that you've all read the act, and I'll be happy to answer questions, but there are 3 items in the act that you need to look at and make some decisions on. The first one is in section 6B1, which I believe is on page 13 of your proposed rule. Yes, it is. If you notice in section 6B1, and this deals with acceptance of the privilege, and the word or misdemeanor is in brackets. And under the conference rules, when you put something in brackets, we're saying to the states, this is your decision. The conference isn't going to take a position whether it should apply, in this case, only the felonies and misdemeanors. Our committee did not make any recommendations on it. But I think it's important that the court do make a decision and select one or both. Be my recommendation that you limit it to felonies. And the reason for that is when you get into misdemeanors, you're talking everything from, you know, traffic tickets on up. And I don't think that there's a need to waive the privilege in the case of somebody says something in a mediation hearing involving a misdemeanor. A felony, yes, that should be important, and I think that should be an exception. So on that one, would be my recommendation. Obviously, the court can do what it wants, but to just leave off the bracketed language or misdemeanor. The second item that you need to address is the effective date. Now, I think probably the court has a proceeding where it sets the effective date of the proposed rules, but the Uniform Act, and this is in section... right toward the end, I think it's the last section. Yeah, section 16, which appears on page 17. Section 16A that says that the act would govern mediation made on or after the effective date of this act. 16B would permit you to, in fact, make it retroactive to mediation agreements that have been entered into prior to the effective date of the act. And if you read the reporter's comment and the official act of the conference, the reporter pretty much recommends that within a certain period of time, lawyers and courts will get used to the Uniform Mediation Act and they'll expect it to apply. And so I think the recommendation would be that you set that for about 1 year out. So like a year from now, all mediations agreements would be covered by this act, even if the mediation agreement was entered into prior to the effective date of the act. Because lawyers will get to assume that the act applies rather than the other way around. So it'd be at least my recommendation that if you adopt the rule, say effective September 1st, that you, in subsection 16B, you put a September 1st, 2008 date. That gives the lawyers the chance to recognize that this is the act and apply after that point to all mediation acts. There's one other, there's a typo actually, and that is on page 14, and it's in section 8, C. There's a cross-reference there to section 126.1, and that should be 125.1. 125.1 is our open meetings law. Obviously, 126.1 is the Administrative Procedures Act, and that has nothing to do with this. But 125.1 is the open meetings law, and obviously, if the open meetings law requires the meeting to be open to the public, this would not preempt that. And so I would suggest that on that particular line, you change that to 125.1. I'd be happy to answer any questions. I could go through the act in some detail, but I don't know if that's necessary. Justice?
Now, does this cover the mediations in domestic relations?
No. There's a specific exception for that. Okay. There's an exception for domestic relations, labor agreements. I think there may be a few other ones in there, too, but it does not cover domestic relations. You have a separate statute, and we've identified that statute in the act.
Further questions for Mr. LeBron?
What about the jurisdiction of the court to do it? Was there any dissent about that?
Not on our committee, and I did a little paper for the committee on it, and like I said, it's a matter of court ruling. I guess the only question that may come up is in an arbitration or a mediation that's not involving the court or litigation. Administrative agencies, the act is drafted to cover that, administrative agencies, that type of thing. When it's adopted by court rule, I don't know, but I would suspect that your current rules of evidence that you've adopted usually apply to administrative agencies. But that would be the only question that I'd have if it came up that way. But the act itself would cover it. Now, because it's adopted by court rule, I suppose somebody could take the position, well, this has nothing to do with the court system, the judicial system, so it wouldn't apply. My guess, lawyers would want to opt into it and use it. It's a matter of agreement. I might mention also, parties can choose to opt out of the act if they want. I don't think that'll happen.
I missed that when I was reading this.
I forget what section that in, but there is a provision in there that... And I'd have to look to find it. That doesn't permit the parties to opt out. But all of them would have to opt out.
Okay.
The other thing I might mention is that there's a section in here about it. For example, if the mediator fails to disclose a conflict of interest, there's a section that says he loses the privilege. The fact that he loses it does not mean that the parties lose it. So the parties could still insist that the mediator could not be called in to testify. Because Chuck Roscoe's on the South Dakota Bar, what's the committee, Tom, the Dispute Resolution Committee, is that what it is? He raised that issue. You know, what happens if the mediator does breach it? And the answer is the parties can still insist that the mediator not testify.
Just so the court knows, if you remember, could you inform us as to the names of the rest of the committee members? Who else was on the committee?
Oh, you bet.
This was what I considered to be a blue ribbon panel.
Tom Martin from Brookings, Chris Palmer from Rapid City, of course Judith Roberts from the court, Jim Ruby from Watertown, Marshall Young, Rapid City, and Tom Welch, Sioux Falls. And I might mention also that Mike Getty, the chair of the draft committee, he came to one of our meetings and gave a presentation on the act and did an excellent job.
Further questions for Mr. LeBrun? If not, please extend our appreciation to your committee for all their fine work.
I just made one final comment. The chief has also asked our committee to look into the question of either qualifications or certification of mediators. And the Uniform Laws Conference draft committee looked at those issues as well and decided not to get into them as part of the Uniform Act. But our committee has assured the Chief Justice we are going to look at it and come back with some type of a recommendation.
Okay. Thank you for coming, Mr. LeBrun. Mr. Barnett, does the bar have a position on this?
No, Your Honor.
Okay. All right. I believe that then would complete all the proposals. Better check to make sure. So, we are in recess.